Welcome to Silent Voices, Stories of MST, the podcast dedicated to survivors of military sexual trauma. Join host Rachel Smith and guests as we provide resources, community, and support for those navigating the aftermath of MST. Together, we aim to raise awareness and foster understanding. If you're struggling, you're not alone. Welcome to Silent Voices, Stories of MST. Again, I'm your host, Rachel Smith, and today we have a brand new episode with an honored guest. I'm so excited to speak with her. Her name is Tanya Jones, and she has a remarkable story, and she is an advocate and the founder of Interactive Advocacy, which has a genius way, I think, of taking on trauma and turning it into something positive. I'm not going to give it away here, but it involves the theater, which is awesome. It started as a way for her to share her story of triumphing over trauma. Tanya's journey takes us through childhood prior to the military service, and beyond. And her experience in military service was quite traumatic, so she found comfort in writing, and she bravely opens up about her struggles with her mental health after sexual assault. It's a very candid discussion, so trigger warning, just in case you need it. I really think that this is such a powerful conversation because you'd still hear the pain in her voice of what has happened during her life, but the amount of pride that comes through that she has helped so many people and that those people are doing the same by writing their own stories. I'm not going to give it away like I said it before, but she shares her insights on the importance of boundaries, self-care, and how transformative writing and storytelling can be. Well, I'm going to wrap this up and let Tanya introduce herself. Enjoy.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for having me this afternoon, Rachel. I appreciate you. And good afternoon for everyone that is joining us. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you so much. We start with our first question, as always, is what led you to joining the military and which branch did you choose?
What led me to join the military? That's actually always a great question. People join the military for so many reasons, right? Some people come into the military because it's a part of their family legacy, right? It's everyone in the family was in the military. Some people join the military because it's a great opportunity, whether it's for school or travel. And then you have other individuals that join the military because the environment in which they were in wasn't the best, and they see this as an opportunity for growth. And for me, it was a place that I thought that I could escape to, right? I was a person that had experienced childhood trauma. And as a result of that, the military just seemed the place that I could hide away from, you know, everyone and everything and all my pain. I am an Army veteran, a disabled Army veteran, actually. So the military was my escape from trauma.
I understand. And it's really amazing to hear how many people are trying to escape trauma. And then when they join, they go through a whole different level of it. And it's just, it's really unfortunate. I'm also a survivor of childhood sexual trauma, but I do think that the predators that are within the ranks, they kind of look for people like us. Like there's little kind of markers that we don't realize we're displaying. And whether that's like maybe being kind of nervous or anxious or not quite as ready to push back on people, they seem to look for that. So sorry to hear that that had happened to you.
Thank you. And that's actually so true. I think as a person that has experienced childhood trauma, one that has never addressed it, you didn't deal with it. There was no therapy. There was only escape. So you're right. You go into the military, and I went into the military looking to escape, but very vulnerable, right? Very, very vulnerable. I didn't know what the red flags were. I didn't know if it looked like someone was genuinely concerned about my well-being. I saw it as, oh, this person cares about me. And so I think you're right. I think predators look for those individuals that establish or that shows, you know, this sense of vulnerability. You may call it being naive. And they're basically looking to see how far I could go with this person, and you totally miss it. When you miss those red flags and you are a person that is vulnerable, it's like you then become prey for the predators, and not just one predator, multiple predators, because it's like they see you a mile away.
I agree. When I did go active duty, I had just left a very scary domestic violence relationship, and I was terrified of my own shadow, and somebody picked up on that right away when I went active duty. So I hear you on that.
Oh, yeah. And then for me, you know, when I was in basic training, I went into basic training with so much pain. I know that my drill sergeants noticed that. Basic training is basically for them to break you down and then to build you back up, right? But when you're breaking down a person that's on solid foundation, it's really easy to build from that. But if you're breaking down a person that's already broken, it's just like, where do you go from here? So some people fight and some people take flight. And for me, everything was fight. I had such a huge chip on my shoulder, according to them. But it was just all of my pain would then turn into anger, you know. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. But it was something that over the years, my family even talked about. They noticed how much I changed and why it seemed like I was just fighting all the time, you know. And a lot of it had to do with me trying to combat some of the trauma that I faced.
So what was that like for you when you left basic and then got to your training and then your first duty station? Was it still kind of anger overflowing as a means of self-protection?
Actually, no. I got to my first duty station. I tried very hard to assimilate in the new environment that I was in. I tried to remind myself that all of the things that had hurt me was behind me and just bury it. I mean, because that's literally what I did. And I did that for years. I literally took all of that and I thought, well, I'll just put it in a closet and just bury it. You know, in the military, that's what they tell you. Suck it up and drive on, right? So, yeah. You know, I'm like, well, I'm going to be this hard charging soldier. I'm going to suck it up. I grew up in New York. Family's from Central America. So I'm going to be okay. I'm going to do what I got to do. But again, you don't see those red flags. So the minute, again, someone starts to show you a little bit of attention, my military sexual assault actually took place at my first duty station. And so I'm the new person, you know, in the organization. And this individual specifically actually was someone that I thought was very attractive. Everybody liked him. He was very friendly. And he was just very friendly to me. And, you know, coming from basic training where it just seemed like everyone was always screaming at you, coming from a home environment where things around you just seemed to be setting. And the minute that person started to show me a little bit of attention, I saw it as something that I wanted to welcome. You know, I'm like, oh, he's good looking and he's really nice and he's giving me all of this attention. He did outrank me. We all worked in the same facility, but he was in a different unit than I was actually in. I didn't realize at that time, I learned this a lot later on, but, you know, it seems to be like whenever you the new set of privates or the new set of PFCs come in, you got all of these guys, you know, or females that kind of check out who the new fresh meat is, so to speak. Right. Totally. And everyone is kind of sizing them up to kind of figure out, you know, how far they can push this person. You know, again, I didn't know that that's what it was. I thought the attention that I was getting was genuinely from someone that liked me. So the first time that he asked me to kind of go out and spend some time with him, I thought, man, this is pretty cool. Yeah, let's get together. You know, let's have lunch and maybe after work we can go together and get some burgers or something like that. And I'm like, great, this is really cool. Like, you know, in my head, I'm thinking this could potentially be, you know, someone that I would spend some time with and that I could date. That was the first problem, you know, him getting close to me. And then one evening, you know, we decided to hang out and he actually came to my room in the barracks. And one thing led to the other. And before I knew it, I had a pillow over my face. And it was crazy because in that particular moment, I was like, oh my God, I think I'm going to lose my life. And all I was saying to myself in that moment was, how did I get here? And everyone is going to blame me for being here. My mom, my dad, my family, they're going to find me and I'm going to be dead. and they're going to be like, it's her fault. And it was just, you know, I just remember, you know, trying to scream. I remember trying to get him off of me. And I just knew in that moment that I wasn't going to make it out of that room. I just knew. And this is in the barracks, you know, and I'm saying to myself, can no one hear me? Can no one hear me screaming? And you know, when he was finished, he literally just got up and left, like if it was okay. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know who to call. I didn't know who to talk to. And in that moment, I just knew that it was my fault. This was my fault. This was my fault. I should have never been alone in my room with him. I should have never invited him there. This was absolutely my fault. And I remember going through the showers. We had back at that time, we had you know how they did the group showers where it was like multiple people can be in there. And I remembered standing in the shower scrubbing myself, and I felt like I just wanted to scrub the skin off of me. I just felt so dirty. And the following day was Sunday. I stayed because it's a weekend. I stayed in bed the whole day. And then Monday I got up and I went to work. Yeah. Like nothing had happened with this shame, with this embarrassment. Maybe about a week or so later, I saw him and he just kind of looked at me like if nothing happened. We just kind of like what's up? And like just gave me a nod and then just before I knew about his business. And I was just like, what happened, you know? And he never said anything about it. And I never said anything about it. And it would ultimately continue every single thing else that happened to me afterwards until I got help, until I decided to talk to someone. And so I didn't report my sexual assault when I was in the military. I didn't report it. I didn't start talking about it until after my second term in the military. I had a break in service. I got out and then I got back in, and I didn't start talking about it until after, because it wasn't until then that I started to learn that there was actually help for me. You know, it's crazy when you come into the military and they talk to you about this stuff, but when you're a young soldier, you don't know. Before I knew you can trust. You see all of these people hanging out together. You see all of these NCOs and their friends, and I'm thinking to myself, somebody has to know that this person is like this. But if these are all of the people that he's associating with, who can I talk to? One evening, I had gotten up. It must have been about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was heading over to the restroom, and I saw my sergeant major coming out of another soldier's room, like 3 o'clock in the morning. And this was maybe a couple of weeks after what had happened to me. So I'm saying, before I knew, you have sergeant majors before I that are exhibiting bad behavior. Go to this sergeant major and report what had happened to me a couple of weeks earlier.
Exactly. Yeah. What time frame would you say that was? Was this in the 2000s?
Oh no, this was in the 90s.
This was
in the 90s when this happened. Oh yeah, this was in 91. And I was saying to myself, what is it that I'm doing wrong? Because I blame myself.
Right.
What is it that I'm doing wrong that I'm getting all of this type of negative attention? Like, what is it? Is it the way that I dress? Is it what I say? Am I too friendly? Am I too, like, what is it that I'm doing? The gentleman that had stalked me prior to him leaving the installation, he ended up getting out on an early release. Back then they would do early retirements, right? So he ended up getting out on an early retirement. And this particular soldier, you know, he was interested in me. And I just was like, I'm not interested in you. For a little while I was, but then I was like, this person is crazy. And what ended up happening was, where I was at the time, I was stationed at Fort Bliss. We used to say Lower Beaumont and Upper Beaumont back then.
Right.
And so he was kind of like at Lower Beaumont and I was at Upper Beaumont. So he could look up the hill and see when my lights went on in the barracks. And because he knew the CQ, the CQ let him come to my room. So he saw when my light came on. I was hanging out with some friends. He saw when my lights came on and came, you know, knocking on my door. It's like 2-3 o'clock in the morning. So I'm like, what are you, you know, like, what are you doing here? And he was like, oh, I just wanted to talk to you, you know, like, where were you at? And I'm like, what difference does it make? Like, why are you here? It's like 2-3 o'clock in the morning. He was like, well, I just want to talk to you. I just want to talk to you. No sooner than I was like, okay, fine. Just talk to me. Like, what is it? You know, no sooner than he got in the room, he was hitting me and I was on the ground. He kind of belted in on me, strangled me, broke two of my ribs before he finished and left. And I was just like, again, how did I get here? Like, how am I in this situation again? Long story short, when I went to the hospital, they was like, you know, like, what happened to you? Back then, I was more afraid of what would happen to me as a soldier if I said, this person did this to me. Like, am I going to be reprised again? Is somebody going to say that this was my fault? Like, what's going to happen to me? So I think if memory serves me correctly, I said something like, I fell down the steps. I fell. I hurt myself. I didn't say that it was him. And a part of the reason also was because I knew he was leaving. So I was like, okay, well, he's going to leave and then I'm going to be okay. But then that's when the stalking started. It started with phone calls to my job. It started with sending me flowers, sending me gifts. And the people that was at the front desk, they used to say, oh, this is so sweet. And like, this is not sweet. This is a crazy person. I don't want this attention. What ended up happening, I went to my first sergeant at the time and I shared with her what was going on. The first thing that she said to me was, well, Tanya, what did you do to get him to send you all of these flowers and send you all of these? And I told him, I said, I didn't do anything. I said, he's crazy. I told her, I said, look, he sent me this ring in the mail. I need you to mail it back to him. I don't care. Like, something is wrong with this person. He's delusional. He's crazy. And then they said, okay, well, we'll kind of keep an eye on it. But back then, it wasn't really that much that they could do. So I remember he had a friend that was in the military, one of his battle buddies that was still there. So I went to him and I said to him, listen, is there any way that you can talk to your friend? Because I'm telling it to my leadership. They're not doing anything about it. Maybe he'll listen to you. And he was like, oh, you know, kind of laughing it off. Oh, time, it's not that big of a deal. You know him. Just ignore him. Like that kind of thing. Then he, at some point, maybe like about 2 months later, maybe about 2 months, because this was going on for about that time, he called him up and told him, hey, listen, I'm coming into town and I need you to pick me up from the airport. Now, literally during the same week, the same individual called my command and left a message on the answer machine of my first sergeant, my command sergeant major, and the commander saying that he was coming to Fort Bliss to kill me. He called them and left them a message. And literally that's how he ended up getting picked up because of that. You know, as a young soldier, when you're dealing with it, so pretty soft, you're away from home, you don't really have any friends. You don't know who you can trust. And you go to your leadership. And the first thing that they say to you is, what did you do? Who do you go to? Who do you talk to? Because the first thing that you do is you believe that whatever happened was really your fault. You believe it. And that literally took me on a course. Right. You know, it is your fault. So you can't talk a certain way. You can't dress a certain way. You can't look at anybody. You know, you got to lower your face when you're talking to people. You're just in a place where you just want to hide all over again. So here I am running away to the military, trying to hide in the military from everybody. How do you do that?
Yeah. And you were just failed on so many levels. And you did everything that people are taught to do is go get help. Go talk to somebody that has power that can help. Go talk to that person's friends, like involve people, and none of them. How I am so sorry. And that is just absolutely terrifying. You were about how old at that time?
I was, at that time, I was like 19.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. I'm a baby.
Like, right, yeah. Right.
Yeah. I'm 19 years old, 20 years old.
You had these experiences and this person did finally get apprehended. What did that shape your opinion of just the world at that point, let alone the military. What did that feel like? Because you have this earlier trauma, then you are re-traumatized several different ways, and then now you just have to live life.
You know, back then, being completely honest, I wasn't in the space where I was blaming the military. I was blaming me. So I wasn't at the military failed me. I was at I failed me. Right. Mm-hmm. So and I didn't want any part of the military at that particular time, only because I was trying to find the next place to run away to. That's really what it was. Let me go back. Let me say this. As a person that has experienced childhood trauma and then experienced MST, again, vulnerable. So those two things happening led me into a domestic violence situation, getting married and being in a domestic violence situation. Now, initially, I didn't know that, again, not paying attention to the red flags, because the red flags were there when we dated. I just saw it as, well, this person likes me so much that he's willing to fight for me, not realizing that that could turn around and I would be the person he would fight next, right? You have one person that has experienced so much trauma back to back to back to back. You're just at that point, like, I'm just hopeless. I don't know what else to do. I want to give up on everything, on life, on everything. I found myself a young wife, and at this point I had gotten out of the military, because like I said, I had a short break in service. I'd gotten out of the military. My husband was still on active duty. Still in the air, I was trying to handle all of this stuff, everything by myself. I'm now pregnant with my first child. In that space, I didn't see myself as being a mother yet, because I was pregnant. I didn't have someone that I had to care for. It was still just me. And I just didn't want to be here anymore. So I attempted suicide and ended up on the psych ward and short list. And I will never forget the nurses that treated me. You know, they reminded me in that moment how selfish I was. You know, they told me that, like, how dare you do this when you're pregnant? You know, how dare you? I didn't recognize that I was pregnant, right? Like, I knew I was pregnant, but I didn't see myself pregnant. I was just thinking about the fact that I don't want to be here no more.
Right.
So I remember her saying this to me. And in that moment, that's when I decided I've got to do something different. That moment. I've got to find a way deal with this shit. Like, I was like, I can't take this no more. And I was already writing. I was already journaling. I was already doing these type of things, of which I thought that it was going to help me heal. But I had to convince the hospital that I wasn't going to hurt myself anymore, and convince them that I was going to go ahead and do the work that I needed to do to start to work on me. That was baby steps. And then ultimately, that I think is what led me on my journey to doing everything that I did or I have now done over the last 25 years.
What a journey. And I'm just so sorry that you were failed to the level that you just no longer wanted to live. I've definitely been in that space where, honestly, like in my opinion, I don't see that act as selfish, because your brain is not making any sort of logical or rational decision at that point, because it's so injured and traumatized that I fully understand you not feeling like a mom yet, or not realizing there's two lives at stake here. I completely understand that. So I'm glad in the sense that it was a wake-up call for you, but that is just so hard to go through. And yeah. when you did finally start reaching out for help, what was the avenue that you went to? Was it just immediately therapy, or?
Well, no, actually, for me, it was, so I had always been a person that wrote, and I kept a journal or diary for years. And one of the reasons why I did that was because I could escape, right? I felt like I could escape in my stories, and I could become victorious in my stories. I could be a superhero. And all of the people that hurt me, I could take vengeance on them, so to speak, right. You know? So it ultimately became the first tool of therapy for me on my journey to resiliency, just starting to write all of this down. And I needed to start to get it out. And I didn't know that I was getting it out. That's ultimately what was happening. It was just a way for me to, it was another place that I could escape to, because I needed to escape. So I could only escape within me. So that's kind of what I did. It ended up being a part of how I shared. You know, I think sometimes too, when you are a person that has experienced trauma, the first step of advocacy, of course, is what the little things that you do for yourself. But sometimes it's not what you do for yourself to heal yourself. It's what you start to do for others, right? Yeah. So I became that person who I like to call the brown girl in the ring, which actually started from my siblings because of childhood trauma, where I had to protect them. Right. I had to protect those that are around me. So I was that go-to person. Well, I wonder how you get this done. Or I wonder how you get that done. So now I'm starting to do more research. I'm starting to learn about, back then it was BOSS and then EO and then EEO and then SHARP. I'm learning about all of these things. And now I'm helping other people around me. Right. And I'm like, well, if I can help them, then ultimately that will help me. And then whenever I would do training, that training would look like storytelling time. Those unparalleled storytelling, because, you know, let me share a little bit of my story with you so that you understand that you're not by yourself. And even though we've had two different experiences with trauma, I understand trauma is real. I understand that what you're feeling is real. And ultimately, I would share that where I am today is not where I was 2 years ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago, right? Now I'm sharing, and ultimately it's growing. It was always afterwards where someone would come to me and say, man, thank you so much for sharing your story like that. Like, I didn't realize how much I needed that. You know, after helping people on a one-on-one level or even in small groups, I realized that it was time for me to really dig in and do some work for me. I had a trigger, and when that trigger hit me and it came out like vomit. That's like how I always explain it. I'm like, it just came out like vomit. And that's when I realized that I hadn't done enough work on me. Right. And so that's when, and I want to say that was probably like 2006, 2007 is when I really started to just do therapy and everything. You know, I'm writing it down. And the cool thing about it was that I was writing stuff down for so long. Like, I had so much stuff that I could unpack. And I'm like, okay, well, let me talk about this. Let me talk about that. And I didn't realize how the writing was actually really helping me until I used it as the tool. It went from just being like my diary to now my journal that I can address the triggers. What is my trigger? What word or what smell or what thing is going to set me off? And then what do I need to do as a coping mechanism so that if I see it, smell it, hear it, you know, see it, I now know how to respond so I don't have to run. And that was the thing. And that also led me to creating boundaries that I love today. Like, I didn't know what boundaries were. Oh, now same. I'm a huge proponent of boundaries. And I'm a huge proponent of the word no as a whole sentence.
Absolutely.
You know, I would be like, no, I'm not doing that. No, not interested. No, I won't be there. No, that'll be all right. No, not next time. Not happening. I'm not operating by anyone else's rules anymore when it comes to how I deal with trauma. Because trauma is real. And trauma causes fear. And if you live with that trauma and that fear long enough to the point where, like you were saying earlier, you now become afraid of your own shadow, it'll paralyze you. You won't want to leave your home. You won't want to have friends. You won't feel safe in any environment. And how long can you live that way? You can't. You're not living. You're just existing.
Yeah.
And I was existing for a long time. I was a slave to trauma for such a long time. I was a slave to childhood memories. I was a slave to not being able to forgive those that had hurt me. I was a slave to, you know, my ex-husband. I was a slave to all of it. And I just was like, I have to be free. I have to be creatively free. So, you know, spending so many years in the military and then working for the federal government, and I've done it all. I've been at IG, I've done EO, EEO, SHARP. I worked at the Army Review Boards Agency, like all the different places that I thought I could help and give back, right? And then I realized that at the end of the day, we're still at the mercy of leadership, right? If it's the mission, and if you have a leader that's, you know, is all in, and you know, you got that leadership buy-in, and they're all excited about it, and they really want to take these programs on and do something about it, great. But if you have a leader that's like, well, that's not really the mission. This is the mission, and we're just gonna deal with this in a reactory way, you know, as something happens. After a while, sometimes it gets a little frustrating. And so that all of those things and ultimately is kind of was the writing on the wall for interactive advocacy. I knew that I was already a writer. I knew that that was something that was already in me and something that I enjoyed to do. And I decided to tell my story. I decided to put it all out there. And so the first play that I ever wrote is called No Words, which is my own sexual assault story. And now that is one of our largest performances to date. And we have traveled, you know, all over the states doing our No Words performance. And it's just been such an honor to watch as these talented actors with such grace to watch retell and reshape and retell my story in such a way that's so beautiful that it has also become healing, right? So that's a part of how interactive advocacy was born.
That is so incredible. And I do want to pull up the clip of interactive advocacy so that people can see this just amazing organization and how it's all come together, because it's beautiful. It really is. It's something that I don't think a lot of people would even have thought to put these two things together in order to help others. But there's this creative soul right here in front of us that is one of this amazing, beautiful ideas. And let me pull that up here real quick.
One of the reasons why I'm so passionate about this work is because I am a thriving survivor myself. I'm also a United States Army veteran, and I worked for the military, both as a civilian and the military, for the better part of 20 years, and I've been doing this work for over 25 years. Providing unparalleled storytelling. When we talk about lived experiences, you want to be able to talk to people who have actually experienced the harm. We hear from other spectators that have also experienced some type of trauma themselves is that this has been so therapeutic for them as well. Not just because they get to see so many different outcomes when they see some of our storylines, but many people are able to say, you've encouraged us or you've empowered us to now share our story, to come forward.
What is your end game?
I'll stop talking about it and my job will be done when it's done, when this stops. And it's sad to say, I came into the military in 1993, when I first came into the military. And we've been talking about sexual assault, sexual harassment, suicide, domestic violence since then. Why are we still talking about it in 2023? I would love there to be a time when someone can say, you know, we don't need interactive advocacy anymore. Because there's no more sexual assault, there's no more suicide, there's no more domestic violence. We don't see it anymore. I talk a lot about the colors in our logo. The colors in our logo are teal, purple, green, and yellow. And the reason why I talk about it so much is because not only am I a thriving survivor of sexual assault, I'm a thriving survivor of suicide, mental health, domestic violence. We can't have experienced sexual assaults and not contemplate some of these other things or have issues with some of these things. I'm a thriving survivor of all of those. And that's a lot of trauma for one person to have to experience. And for me, I never let trauma define who I am. While I understand that those are my scars and I live with them, not to the point that I'm gonna sit and not do something about it. And again, we show everybody, we show the perpetrator. Our presentations are not just for the survivor, not just for the victims, but it's for those people that are also just riding on the fence. Those people who don't even know that what they're doing is inappropriate, that maybe they can look on the stage and see themselves and say, you know what? Oh my gosh, am I that person? Am I her? Am I him? Am I them? And hopefully can say, wow, if I don't clean this up, then I can be the one kind of walking off the stage in handcuffs, you know? Yeah, that's why we do what we do. I mean, we're a bunch of passionate, wacky veterans.
So what I absolutely love about this video is the genuine joy on all of these people's faces after facing that kind of trauma, because when you go through something like that, it is like you are completely robbed of it. You're robbed of joy, you're robbed of hope, you're robbed of any sort of inner peace or light, and giving that back to these people. So how does that feel?
Oh, that's amazing. There's all this joy that we get, strong accolades from the audience, from the leadership, from the commanders, from the schools, from everyone. Like there's always a long line to talk to us after we're done. And I'm always humbled by that. But after we leave and we get on our bus, we go back to our hotel and it's just us. Everyone is just like, Ms. J, thank you so much for creating this organization, for giving us a voice, for giving us a platform to share, because we didn't even know that we needed this. Again, some of our edutainers, some of our facilitators have experienced their own trauma, right? They all have their own stories. So it's healing for them. And, you know, they were already actors. Some of them were actors that were also passionate about social justice awareness. And it was like, you have brought these two worlds together in such a way that has also become healing for us. And the content, the work, it's heavy. You know, the subject matters are heavy. Because it's not just sexual assault we're talking about. Sexual assault, suicide, domestic violence, human trafficking. Like, one of our team members is a survivor of human trafficking. This, you know, it's like you can't even imagine being fortunate enough to talk to someone that survived something so traumatic and lived in something, you know, terrible, you know, and to be able to use comedy and drama and storytelling to heal. It's a beautiful thing, you know. It's art is so beautiful anyway. And I just love creatives because they're able to tap into a whole nother realm. And if you're able to use art and use creative expression, poetry, music, anything like that to assist you in healing, I am so here for it. I am so here for it. Actually, I was on a panel discussion just recently, and we were talking about male victims and male victims of trauma, and they do hip hop therapy. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's so different. And I was like, yeah, you know, and it was a great one because they could be vulgar and they could be in their feelings, but they could release,
right?
You know, they could absolutely release. And so whatever that thing is that you can tap into that will at least get you to the very next day, right? Because sometimes it's just the next day. You can do that one thing that can get you to the very next day. That's half the battle right there.
That's very true. I did want to bring up, so you said that your story was the very first performance. Were you in that performance or were you seeing that from the audience?
Ooh, it's always hard for me to talk about that performance. Whenever we go back to that very, very first performance, it's like I'm right in the room. To be completely honest with you, the first time that I saw it performed on stage, I thought I was going to come undone. I did. I thought I was like, I'm going to fall apart. I'm going to fall apart. I was definitely not in the play. I was sitting in the audience. I was the facilitator because we do our productions and we couple our productions with some facilitation, you know, with some podium time from either one of the facilitators or one of the trainers or one of the doctors. I was sitting in the audience in the front row. The music comes on and they kind of make their way up to the room and the scene begins. The couple is on the bed. They start kissing. and the woman starts to push the person's arms away. And, you know, he goes back and he tries to touch her again, and she pushes his hand away. The reason why the story was called No Words, it was because the word stop never came out of the actor's mouth. And it never came out of my mouth. Like, I couldn't remember saying stop, like stop, no, like no. I remembered all this other stuff, but I couldn't remember if I said that thing. And I thought I didn't say that thing. And maybe that's why, you know. So we call it No Words because it was more about the visual action. And as a reminder that even if I do this thing, that still means no. Like, you don't have to hear those words. So anyway, I'm sitting in there and I'm like, I'm gonna lose it. But I managed to keep it together. I, of course, it made me cry, you know, and I was very emotional, but not to the point where I thought I'm gonna have to leave me. I was able to see the whole performance. But I think in the end, when I heard the applause from everyone in the audience.
Yeah, just a very powerful moment.
When I heard the applause from everyone in the audience, and I saw how many people were just so moved, and just the way that the actors handled the story, they did it with such eloquence. It was something that was so traumatic that was happening in front of you, but you couldn't look away. It's like you felt compelled, like you wanted to run up there and rescue this person.
Right.
And it was like, you know, I just needed all of these people to see it and what they did in that moment. They all became my hero. You know, they all rescued that young girl, you know? They all had my back in that moment.
Yeah,
and it was just beautiful. Yeah, it was beautiful. And so one of the things that I like about that story is that the way that I wrote it so that the characters could be ambiguous, right? So, you know, we could take that same storyline and now make it a male on male. Now make it a female on female. Now make it a female as the perpetrator and a male. Because there's so many people in the audience that story could resonate. The first time that someone came to me and said, thank you for sharing that story, you just gave me the courage to report.
Oh my goodness.
What a now I knew I was onto something.
Yeah.
And the first time that a male soldier came to me, I will never forget his face. I will never forget where we were. I will never forget this. When he came to me, he told me that he was a victim of sexual assault and that he had not shared his story with anyone and that I just empowered him. I just said, you know what? I'm doing the right thing. I needed to be able to tell this story to help one person. I needed to be able to tell this story so that perpetrators can see, we're watching you. We know that you're out there. We're talking to you. This story is for you. Because some people, you know, they exhibit all of this behavior and toxic behavior, you know, because they just think that it's not that bad. They're pushing those boundaries. Nobody is checking them. You know, they're just like, I'm in this bubble and nobody doesn't see. No, we see you. We see you. And the hope is, especially when we're talking to that 18 to 26 demographics, right? Those young people. A lot of times they find themselves in trouble because they didn't get consent. Because they didn't ask, because they thought, well, she said yes yesterday, so that must mean yes today. Or, well, she said no, but I just thought she was playing hard to get, right? She was sending me signals and all of that BS that we hear.
Yeah.
But if we can get them to see themselves on stage and say, oh, shoot, then it isn't the wrong thing. Or if somebody is saying, yo, like, dude, that's you, or excuse me, but sorry, that's you, or commander, that's you, or I see someone behaving that way. And then the responsive bystander says, I got to say something. I saw this person do this. I saw this person say this thing. I can't sit here and say someone else got it. Someone else going to take care of it. Because what if they don't? And it goes that far. So you got all these people that are watching what's happening on stage and now saying, I'm going to act. I'm also going to act. Actively create transformation. Actively create transformation. Transformation in our organizations to create a culture of cheering people. And that's not just, my job is to do this type of training so that we can dismantle the rates in which violence occur. And if I can do that in comedy, and if I can do that through drama and storytelling and creative expression, then I'm going to do it. Because you're going to connect to those storylines. And when you leave, you're going to remember. You're going to remember what you experienced with interactive advocacy.
And to me, that sounds like you've come full circle from just writing about being a superhero to now having that major influence on so many lives, whether it's just one person in the audience or 50, which is, that is just incredible that people, I can't even imagine the range of emotions that are happening throughout one of these shows.
So whenever we open our show, we always tell everyone, you know, if you've never experienced an interactive advocacy training event, I just want to make sure that we'll let you know that, you know, we're going to make you laugh, we're going to make you cry, but we're going to always do it in a space learning environment. Yeah. And, you know, and that's what we want to do. You know, we've got to get you to laugh about some of this stuff because we're talking about heavy topics so that by the time the tears come, you know, you're okay. We're going to give you some tears, but then we're going to turn around and turn into some stuff that you're going to laugh about. But when you walk away, you're going to walk away having learned something. You're going to walk away really feeling empowered and committed to act.
I hear you. That is beyond incredible. And in the video, you had mentioned that you know your work is done when this is eradicated. What are some of the smaller goals for your organization? Because that's a very, very big picture. So do you do performances on installations as well?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So that performance that you saw was a snapshot of us at one of the military bases in San Antonio, Texas. And that video particularly, I always say, you know, nobody doesn't know what's going on behind the scenes. I was so sick. I had a fever of 103.
Oh,
no one knew. I was burning up. And then it was like, Ms. Jones, are you going to? I said, no, we got to go. Let's go. And they tell me, you know, Ms. J, the way you put your game face on. And I'm like, had anybody known, I was about to pass out. I'm like, no, this is what we do. Like, this is what gets my blood boiling in a positive way. Like, I get so excited. So we travel everywhere. We go to military installations. I'm really excited. We're going to be doing some training with the Pentagon in April. So this is going to be the second time that we've done training with them. So we're really excited about it. So, you know, any military organization, non-military organization, corporate America, sports industry, if you have more than 5 people in your organization, we've got something for you. We have so many different variations of our show. The No Words Performance is our big show. And when I say big, I mean big, big in size because it has the most actors. It's about 12 people performing in that production. And then we have some of our smaller shows and small only on size, not on impact. Because any show that you come to that's interactive advocacy, it's going to be bold, it's going to be provocative, and it's going to be impactful. So even if it's just 2 performers, 2 actors, we're going to talk about it. We will be in your face. Very immersive and engaging, so it requires audience participation. And you know, you're not going to be able to come to one of our presentations and sit back.
Right.
If that's the type of show you wanted, then you probably didn't want interactive advocacy. and we get everybody involved, from the 2-star all the way down to the private. Everyone is involved in our performances, and we love it. And we love it. And, you know, people seem to really be excited about the shows that we bring.
Definitely. And just the excitement and passion in your voice is so commendable that you've been able to accomplish this much. And that does bring me to the final question here. So now that you've been able to inspire and transform not only your performers, but anybody in the audience, and you had the validation and the experience of seeing people want to come rescue you, what would you say, having accomplished all of this to those people that had harmed you and stalked you and just gotten away with just being terrible, basically, what message would you give to them now, being this woman that has impacted so many lives for the better with those experiences?
Honestly, I've never really thought about, let me take that back. I have thought about, if I could say something, what would I say? And to date, I haven't been able to come up with the thing that I would say to them to date. So where I have found solace, where I have found peace, is not in what I would say to them, but it is what I would have said to me. And what I always say to me, anytime I forget, anytime I think about the pain, anytime I think about the horror, anytime I have flashbacks, I remind myself to forgive myself. Forgive your younger self, Tonya, because you did the best that you could do in that situation. There is nothing that you could have done in that moment that would have changed that outcome. It was not your fault. Forgive your younger self. And so I have always focused on that. I've never, and I've tried. I've tried before. Like, what would I say? Like, what would I say? And when I think about what I would say, I go back to writing, and the story then becomes about me and how I would champion on.
Right.
So I think that leads to, I never let trauma define who I am. Trauma doesn't define me. And as long as I hold on to that, I'm going to continue to move forward every day. I'm going to continue to wake up every day and feel blessed and be grateful and be filled with so much gratitude that I've gotten to take all this stuff that caused me so much pain and turn it into something so beautiful that someone can say to me, thank you for using your voice. So I'm going to focus on that.
I can't imagine how many people truly need to hear that, because a lot of the depression and the anxiety and just overall hopelessness is that I blame myself for this thing happening to me. So I can't, so many people do need to hear that, even if it's something they've heard a million times. That reminder is just, this was not your fault. This is completely someone else's choice, and they have to live with that. That stain is on their soul for the rest of their lives. Not you.
Yeah. And you know, I remember I was talking to my sister one time, and she said to me, sister, you think you'll ever want forgiveness? I said, forgiveness? Forgiveness for who? I said, you know, I'm forgiving them a long time ago for me, so I don't have malice,
right,
and hatred and anger in my heart, because that makes you sick, right?
It literally
does. It makes you sick, mentally, physically, emotionally. It makes you sick. Been there, done that. Got the T-shirt. So I made a decision to forgive, but I don't need apologies,
right?
I don't need an apology. I don't need well, this is the reason. I don't need an explanation. Like, I don't need or want anything from that person. Like, I don't, like, I feel like that is your cross or your sin to bear. And that's between who you and whoever you believe is your maker. Yeah. And I want you to fester in that. Because to me, the minute that I focus on what's okay for that person to say and or do, it's like I'm giving them an okay, like a pass. Like I'm anything that I could say to them, any, like just an interaction from me, if I know that they were out there and they could hear it, I feel that's giving them, I made my peace. It's better that you dwell in that thing that you did. I believe that there's a place for you.
And it's kind of hot there.
I mean, you know, I don't talk about religion, but you know, I believe that there's a place for you, and you don't get a pass just because, you know, you said I'm sorry, or you changed your life around, or you know, you can do all of these great things. Okay, that's between you and your maker.
Right.
You know, ask them for forgiveness, not me, because for me, I'm good, and I'm healing every day, and I'm happy, and I'm, you know, I'm wonderful. You know, my mom said to me one time, she said, "Why are you talking about this stuff so much?" She said, "You know, you're doing all these great things. You're such a better boy. Like, why do you want to suffer so much?" And I said, "Mom, I love you so much. I said, you're so beautiful. You just want to take care of your baby. I know. I said, but mama, just what I need you to realize, it's because I'm on this journey of healing that I can talk about it.
Right.
And I couldn't talk about it, that's when y'all needed to worry. But now that I'm talking about it, y'all ain't gonna be able to shut me up."
So true. And I, like you said, a piece of advice that I've never really liked, but people, I've heard it throughout my, when I first asked for help. So that was probably like 2015. And people would say, the best revenge is a life well lived. And I'm like, the best revenge is not needing revenge. I don't want this person to have any sort of impact on any part of my happiness or well-being or life. Like you said, like your apology means absolutely nothing to me.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's like, it goes back to the boundaries thing. You don't even have access to my happiness.
Exactly.
You know, it's like I don't even see you. You know what I mean? Like, you don't even exist
right
to me.
Yep.
I personally, I don't need that. And I realized that a long time ago. And so I'm going to definitely live my best life. And I'm going to be a warrior, and I'm going to thrive.
Exactly.
And I'm no longer going to just exist.
And your best life has absolutely nothing to do with it.
No.
Oh, it's funny. Thank you so much for joining us. Is there any organizations that you'd like to shout out?
So I love giving shout outs to the National Organization for Victims Assistance. I was actually on their advisory board. It's an organization that I'm very passionate about. I'm no longer an advisory board member. I was actually a chair. But I'm still very passionate about the amazing work that they're doing. And they actually just had a name change. So it's the National Organization for Victim Advocacy, near and dear to my heart. I love them. And I will be there with them at this year's 50th annual celebration in Washington, D.C. So if you want to see interactive advocacy, we'll be at NOVA. We'll have a booth there. So come by, stop and see us. But other than that, you know, just all of the amazing organizations that are out there in this work every single day with no accolades in private, whether you are, you know, a domestic violence shelter or you are a large organization working in human trafficking. I just want to say to each and every one of you that fight the good fight when it comes to violence prevention and survivors that I salute you. Thank you so much for the work that you do.
Absolutely. And if people wanted to learn more about interactive advocacy, how they can get involved, if they can donate, anything like that, how can they reach you?
Absolutely. So you can check us out on everything at Interactive Advocacy. My website is www.interactiveadvocacy.com. And you can check us out on our social media platforms at Interactive Advocacy. You can even jump on over and see some of the wacky things that I do with creative expression on Just Me, hashtag Just Me Tanya Jones or at Just Me Tanya Jones. All things Interactive Advocacy, just Google us and we're everywhere.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Tanya. This has been such an experience. And I'm sure anyone listening to this is they're going to have several takeaways. And honestly, what you do is just, it's so incredible and so inspiring. And I love that you've incorporated so much of your passions into helping others and found such a beautiful and creative way to get that sort of healing out to other people and change lives. It's nothing short of incredible. I keep saying it, but.
No, Rachel, thank you so much. And thank you. Thank you for this platform. I mean, what you're doing is great as well. You know, just giving survivors the opportunity to share their stories. So thank you so much for what you do. And I salute you too. And thank you for your service.
Thank you. Yep. One story at a time. We're gonna change the world.
That was Tanya's story, and to me, it really hit home as a former theater kid and someone that's been through MST. I thought it was just a brilliant way to process that trauma by actually giving it life again and then letting other people experience exactly what she or any of the members of Interactive Advocacy went through during their time of pain. And it really resonated with me, so I'm sure it will with you. Because Tanya is really empowering survivors by sharing their stories because they're embracing them and they are actively calling for a change of culture within the military. So I think that that's amazing. And we need to all come together and work towards creating transformation. And we need to support those affected by this kind of trauma. So if you want to leave Tanya a message, which I'm sure you do, if you go to silencevoicesmst.com, click episodes tab, and you can click her episode, and right underneath the player between the two episode buttons for previous and next, there is a button that says send Tanya a message. So you can go there, leave her some encouragement, tell her how much you related. And also, you can even ask how you can get involved with Interactive Advocacy. As you heard during the episode, they actually go travel around bases. Next week, our guest is a mom and an author that figured out that kids are also really affected by PTSD when their parent is going through it. She found this out during her healing journey after MST. And what was birthed from that were these really awesome books. I absolutely adore them, and you will too. They are an incredible resource to help kids understand PTSD and why mommy or why daddy are acting differently now. We'll hear her story and much, much more in next week's episode. Until then, I'm your host, Rachel Smith. And as always, I invite you to stay safe, be kind, and take care. We'll see you next time. Thank you for joining us on Silence Voices Stories of MST. If you found this content helpful, don't forget to subscribe for more resources and support. Remember, you're not alone in this journey. Together, we can create a more supportive and understanding community for survivors of MST. Until next time, we'll see you later.